Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again. We're about to have a conversation with Howard Gardner, who is the John H. and Elizabeth A. Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, Senior Director of the Harvard Project Zero, a MacArthur Fellow, and has been on the show several times. And one of his most important works for many of us is the work around multiple intelligences to change our way of thinking about how we learn, what intelligence means. It's not all guided by the standardized tests that seem to be, perhaps many would say, the bane of our public school system in America today. His latest book is Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. And Howard Gardner, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Tell us a bit about, first, the genesis of this book, because clearly it's tied to The Disciplined Mind, a book that you wrote much earlier.
Absolutely. In The Disciplined Mind, which came out about a decade ago, I argued that the purpose of education for the time, for our time, is to help people think about what is true and what is not, what is beautiful and what is not, and what is good and what is not. And of course, when I'm talking about good, I'm talking about morality and ethics. When I'm talking about beauty, I'm talking about the arts and about nature. And when I'm talking about truth, I'm talking about the truths of the different disciplines, historical truth, scientific truth, mathematical truth, and so on. I realized in the intervening decade that the book was naive. And I recognized that both because people said to me, Howard, you're naive. Naive in the sense of, well, you know, it's not so easy to know what's beautiful and what's good and what's true, and we don't just want you to tell us. Moreover, the more severe postmodernists would say, you know, truth is just about who pays for it, who's got the power, who's got the microphone. It doesn't have anything to do with some pure crystalline sense of truth. And the other thing which challenged me was the emergence of the new digital media, social networking, resources like Wikipedia, multi-user games, the web, which everybody uses in one way or the other, and it makes it much trickier to figure out, I mean, what's true in Wikipedia? If you look up something one day and the next day, it's totally different. How can you know? Beauty used to be, you know, the three or four privileged works of art in the museum or at the concert hall, and now there are millions of things posted, and they can be morphed and transformed and deleted with without any kind of thought. And the new digital media, all of us know, it's a wild west. We don't have a sense of who owns what in the new digital media. We don't know what to trust. We don't know how to make ourselves trustworthy. There's a whole question of privacy. Does it exist anymore? So I said to myself, you know, you've got to rethink these traditional virtues, truth, beauty, and goodness, in light of the philosophical critique, what's called postmodernism, and in light of the new digital media. And so my shorthand is the virtues in the era of truthiness and Twitter. Twitter, of course, everybody knows. It's the very short messages that anybody can send to anybody else if they want, or can post for millions of people to look at it. And truthiness is Stephen Colbert's clever word for, well, if I say it often enough, it's true, even if there's no warrant for it. I mean, death panels is a good example of truthiness. There's no death panels that anybody has proposed, but if you say it often enough, people say, well, it must be true. So that's the problem I decided to confront in the new book, Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed.
So in that book, in your earlier book, The Disciplined Mind, I know that you focused some on the teaching certain three subjects, theory of evolution, music of Mozart, lessons of the Holocaust, that would kind of bring these three ideas to light, truth, beauty, and goodness, would bring them to the fore. Did that change in your mind? Has it broadened since then?
I think about it quite differently now. In the case of each of the three virtues, I think we need to be thinking differently about what we teach and how we teach than we did in a, shall we say, more exhibit case world, like those three examples. In the case of truth, I think we really have to focus on method, and that is, how do people figure out as well as we can what actually happened and what didn't? And that applies to journalism. You know, what's the difference between a reporter who spent a lot of time trying to confirm things and triangulating his or her reporting and not reporting things anonymously, and a blogger who just says, well, you know, President Obama said this today, and this is what it means, and neither of those things is true. Or it could be about John Boehner. It doesn't matter who it is. So the methods that people use to establish the truth of journalism, the truth of history, the truth of science, and so on, I think we need to focus much more on that, because there's already way more information around now than anybody could possibly monitor. So we have to figure out what is it that we can believe and what are the methods that were being used. So I would focus much more on the methods and less on whether we teach about evolution or whether we teach about the Second World War or whatever. In the case of beauty, I actually think it's a wonderful time, because we have, for the first time in human history, access to just about all the works of art that have ever been created anywhere.
Right.
And the challenge there is to put together what I call a personal portfolio of what you like, why you like it, and particularly how it differs from other things. I'm not interested in if you like something because it costs a lot of money or because somebody else recommends it. I'm interested if you like something because you can see or hear the differences between that and something else which belongs to the same category, between one poem and another, between one work of art and another, including works that you produce yourself. I mean, one may be more beautiful than the other, but if you can't see the difference, then I'm not much interested in what you're doing. And the wonderful thing about this is it's not zero sum. A good analogy is with food. You know, as we get older, we get exposed to different kinds of foods, and anybody who likes exactly what they liked at age 10 hasn't grown very much. And I think it's the same thing having to do with art and nature. The more we experience things, the more we think about it, the more we talk to other people about it, our tastes will change, and that's quite wonderful, because while I think ultimately truth is convergent, if we know enough and have the best methods, we can really figure out more and more accurately what's happening. Beauty, there's no longer ever going to be a single canon of what's beautiful. So it's more what we find beautiful and why. And in the case of goodness, that's really the trickiest. And I make a distinction in the book between neighborly morality and the ethics of roles. Neighborly morality is what the Ten Commandments is about. It's what the Golden Rule is about. It's basically what do you do and what don't you do to your people who live in your community. And that's something where we have thousands of years of preparation, maybe even evolutionary preparation. And, you know, you don't need Howard Gardner to help you think about not killing or not committing adultery or not stealing and dishonoring your parents, things like that. But we live now in a very complex global world where all of us are occupying roles which could not have been anticipated even 100 or 200 years ago. One are professional roles, you know, whether you're a teacher or a journalist or a doctor or a nurse, these are much more complicated than ever before. And also, you're no longer just living on your block. You're a citizen of your town, of your state, of your nation, and increasingly of the world.
Right.
I mean, if I have an illness and I go on a plane and I fly to Timbuktu, I'm not being a good citizen. If I have a gas guzzler and I pollute the atmosphere, I'm not just bothering the people down the block, I'm contributing to global warming by almost everybody's estimate. And so figuring out the ethics of roles, how are we good workers and how we are good citizens, we need all the help we can get. And what I call for in the book is an establishment of what I call commons, spaces where people can talk about the ethical issues that have arisen at their workplace, the ethical problems that they've arisen in trying to be a citizen. And we're not always going to get it right, but if we reflect on what we've done and we share our mistakes and our miscues and what we did to correct it, the chances that other people and that we ourselves will become better workers and better citizens are enhanced. In almost any complex issue that people wrestle with now, you know, whether it's climate change or stem cell research or what sorts of people should be indicted and convicted, these are not things we're going to find the answer to in the Bible. The fields have gone way beyond the answers which would have been adequate a couple thousand years ago. I mean, you know, just think about the internet and the stuff that we've learned in recent years about our political figures. The Bible is not going to help us decide to do what to do with people who've crossed various lines, whether it's not telling the truth or not being faithful. And these are things that we have to discuss and debate the pros and cons of. And I don't see any way of doing it except through a commons. But the wonderful thing, both with reference to beauty and with reference to goodness, is because of the internet, we can share these ideas and these arguments with many, many people and get their input. We don't have to figure it all out by ourselves.
So what's interesting to me is that I think that several things in here that if you pull together some of the things you're writing, like that as the end of your book, you talk about we don't know what's going to happen in the future. The chance, the fate, vagaries are important because we just don't know where things are going to end up or who's going to end up where, are really in some ways connected to why you, in the beginning of the book and all the way through as subtext and text, the book, you take on those who see things purely through a biological lens, like the evolutionary biologists, and those who see things purely through an economic lens, as defining human beings and behavior. So, I mean, to me, those things are connected.
Right, absolutely. In every era, but we happen to live in the current one, there are certain explanatory frameworks which gain very wide acceptability. And there's almost always some truth to them. They don't come out of thin air. But they become so much a part of the atmosphere that we breathe that people often don't see the limitations. So in the case of evolutionary psychology, almost every trait and behavior of human beings is now analyzed in terms of what was its survival value. And so if you have people who say, well, we're all altruistic, they say, well, that must have had survival value. On the other hand, if you people say, well, we're all very selfish, then the answer is that must have been survival, had survival value. So you can see, since we can make a survival value for everything, it doesn't really get you very far. In fact, in the New York Times, they just had an article about whether people are not really interested in pursuing the truth, but just in winning arguments.
All right.
And then they give an evolutionary argument why, but there are plenty of evolutionary arguments why you want to get it right. And I could argue that the people who became leaders were ones who got things right, not particularly people who were better arguers. They maybe won the debating championship instead. So I think evolutionary psychology is probably very good at explaining male-female relations. But once we get into, you know, what does it mean to be good, to be, a good citizen, or what does it mean to be a good teacher? Evolutionary psychology. I mean, here's a good example. You're a teacher of 30 kids. You've got one or two problem kids in the class. How much time do you spend with those problem kids, and how much time do you spend with the rest of the class? The Bible's not going to give you that answer. Or you are a very accomplished historian. You teach a very good history class. A new set of standards are just announced by the state. You think they're total nonsense. But on the other hand, you have to help kids pass the test. These are ethical dilemmas which need to be argued about and debated. They're not things where you can look in Leviticus or in Solomon and find the answer. They're not there. As for economics has become the big explanatory device for almost everything having to do with human beings. And even though the economics profession has huge egg on its face because of the Enron collapse in 2001 and because of the Lehman Brothers collapse in 2008, and even though it turns out that so many of our economists are actually being paid by governments or by hedge funds to come up with certain views and not others, people still think that the basic laws of economics, number one, it's good for people to act in their self-interest. Number two, that markets are always self-correcting. That's still what most people believe. And if you try to say, "Well, look, the evidence doesn't support it at all," you look like you're just being an iconoclast. So, in some mark, I'm saying is sure, both economics and evolutionary psychology have their place, but I'm saying the two other things that have a place too. One is the vagaries of history. Nobody predicted that the Berlin Wall would fall in 1989. Nobody predicted right. There would be an Arab Spring in the spring of 2011. And human beings can make a difference. I happen to be a great admirer of Gandhi, but just this morning I was in my own mind comparing Gandhi and Hitler. And they both had enormous influence on the 20th century, indeed going into the 21st century. These were two human beings. They were made of flesh and blood, just like everybody who's listening to this program. They had basically the same DNA. And yet, neither evolutionary psychology or rational choice economics can give you a particle of evidence for why these people became the way they did, moreover, and predicted the kind of effect that they would have. So that's what I'm arguing for. Let's be aware of these monolithic attempts to explain a all human behavior via economics or evolutionary psychology on the one hand. Let's realize that, you know, there are tsunamis and oil is discovered. These are things which nobody can predict. And let's realize that people can make a difference, and some people can make an enormous difference for good or for ill.
Now, the whole idea, these are three things you bring to us, truth, beauty, and goodness. They're all very different. And as you write in the book, which gets to in a little while, that the notion of goodness in some ways, a beauty, I mean to say, is maybe not as pivotal as truth and goodness in your perspective.
I guess what I would say is that for many of us, next to our families, what gives us the greatest pleasure in life, and even what gives us the greatest meaning in life, are the beauties. It could be the beauties of nature, a mountain. It can be a backyard, a garden. It can be plants and animals that we love. In my own particular case, it's much more about the kinds of music I like to listen to, the kinds of fiction and poetry I like to read, the kinds of artwork that I like to visit in museums and wish I could have in my house. And, you know, nobody would argue that those things are more important than having food in your belly or having a roof over your house. But I think most of us in developed countries are lucky enough that we don't have to worry inordinately about that. And I was just today doing a blog where somebody was talking about, is there a place for passion when people are looking for work? And I said, look, it's not an either or. There are many of great artists and scientists who had day jobs that weren't particularly interesting, but it didn't keep them from having passion. So yes, I think the meaning in life comes often from beauty. And if we think about past civilizations, a lot more people can talk about and can envision, so to speak, the art of China or India or Rome or Greeks from thousands of years ago than can tell us who were the leaders of those countries or how the economic system was doing. So yeah, I don't feel at all defensive about including beauty. I think the important thing to say here, and it's a bit politically incorrect, is that while I would love to have arts education in school, and I really would like my own kids to have arts education, either in school or, you know, if I can afford private lessons or to go to the neighborhood arts center, there's much more possibility now of people taking arts education in their own hands, both because we have access to so much, hopefully legally, on the internet, but also because of Web 2.0 and Web 3.0, people can create works of art using all sorts of programs which would have been not even visible 30 or 40 years ago. So the terrain for arts is much more open than it was in the past. So I'm not at all apologetic for including the arts, but I will say that the truth establishing function is really what I think education needs to focus on now, particularly by which I mean formal education in the schools. We really need to understand the methods whereby we separate truth from chatter, truthiness, falseness, rhetoric, etc.
I mean, one of the things you said about beauty, and I want to jump right into truth because truth in all this, in some ways, is one of the most complex things to wrestle with. And goodness, in a philosophical, moral sense, is as well. But truth is really, really tricky. And I want to talk about that with you. But when you were talking about beauty, I was thinking about the people I recently entertained, as well as people I've been talking to, friends of mine who are live on the Wind River Reservation, which is an Arapaho reservation in Shoshone out in Wyoming. He's an artist, but he doesn't call himself an artist. But he makes these incredible pieces. And for him, that's beauty. But it's beauty that is also just part of culture. It's not as if you're creating beauty or just to look at beauty. It's functional, but it is beauty. And sometimes we think, when we look at beauty, we think of what has come out of the Western mind a lot. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very valid point. I would say objects and experiences that we care about.
Right.
We care about differences, whether it's food or how somebody walks or how somebody puts on a party or how somebody loves somebody else or how somebody lays out their backyard. Those are all grounds where beauty discriminations can be made, and they can be part of your portfolio. I guess I use examples from the arts primarily in the book because those are things which are accessible to everybody.
Right.
I would love to use nature, and I talk a bit about nature, but I can produce paintings and poems and things like that. But yes, no, I mean the caves in southern Europe magnificent creations long before people even had a word for beauty, but it was stuff that people cared about and were willing to spend time on and to use craftsmanship. And that can be in any area, and whether you have the word beauty or not is not particularly relevant.
And beauty is, I think you would agree and say, that is something we may never completely come to grips and agree with in the end, no matter what, where, when and where we live. But for you, truth is or one of those things we have to wrestle with and come to some understanding.
That's right. And the big problem now, there are different names for it, but it's called the mirror problem, the echo chamber problem, the big sort problem. It's very easy in the digital era simply to expose yourself to people who agree with you and vice versa, and that's often a polarizing rather than a truth-seeking endeavor. And what I say in the book, Mark, is the potential for figuring out what's really going on is much, much greater now than ever before in human history. And I can make a very sharp contrast. Mm-hmm. In my lifetime, and maybe in that of some of your listeners, there were three television networks at 6 or 7 o'clock at night.
Right.
If you turn the television, that's what they broadcast. A man named Walter Cronkite, who was more trusted than the president, said, and that's the way it is, June X, 2011. And a man named Eric Severide explained what it means. Those days are over. However, a lot of what was reported on those networks turns out not to have been true, either because it was deliberate lying and dissembling, or because it just wasn't enough due diligence now. You can be sure now that anything that anybody says that's controversial, there will be an army of people trying to investigate it. And what's funny, Mark, is that even the people who claim the truth is an outmoded notion, when they can do a gotcha, what can they say? Oh, look, Nancy Pelosi said this and it wasn't true, or Eric Cantor said this and, oh, it wasn't true. They're delighted. So the very fact that they're rejecting a notion of truth is undone by the fact that when they actually find somebody in a falsehood, they make a big deal about it. But the important takeaways from the book is, number one, you have to master the methods that people, whether they're historians or scientists or journalists, use to figure out what really happened. And you have to be diligent. You have to be able to not just pay attention to what people on your side, so to speak, say, but to what people on other side say, because you may not have the whole truth. And anybody who, if you ask them, what if you changed your mind on, if they can't give you an answer about that, whether it's about the relationship between nature and nurture, or whether it's about how to do child rearing, or whether it's about, you know, should you vote one way or the other, you know, is what I call a fundamentalist, a person with a commitment not to change his or her mind. And, you know, you can put yourself in that kind of mirror chamber or echo chamber where you only expose yourself to people who agree with you, but that's very sad.
And, you know, as you point out with truth, before we go to break here, is that there are all kinds of truths you're talking about. I mean,
right.
There's historical truth, there's journalistic truth, there's the varied mathematical truths. I mean, there are truth means different things in different disciplines and different viewpoints.
Absolutely. There is no single truth. Just to compare history and science, they're historical truth and scientific truth. Scientific truths are established by experiments and by observations, which by their very nature can be repeated. And if they're not repeated, then we don't call it scientific truth. Historical truth, it only happened once. We're arguing now these days about what actually happened in Lexington and Concord in 1775. Well, there's actually only one thing that happened. Nothing else did happen, and neither you nor I nor 99% of the people who weigh in on this actually know, but there have been a lot of historians who spent a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what Paul Revere was doing, why he was doing it, how he was doing it, and if you pay attention to all that, you've got a much better sense of what happened than if you just listen either to what Sarah Palin said or what some critic who would say everything she says is nonsense would say. And in fact, Jill Lepore has written in New Yorker about what we actually know about what happened in 1775. And the same thing is true about any other historical event. Not that we ever will figure out finally, but if we use enough sources and we argue enough about what happened, we're going to be much, much closer to it than if we just pay attention to one source, which could even be faked.
I mean, you mentioned one of the things really hit me with this short quote you had earlier in the book by Benny Morris, that believes that there is a historical truth and that it's the historian's duty to reach it. And I was thinking about America today as I was reading that. After I read it, what popped in my mind was we're in the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, and if there was ever a truth that America has wrestled with and does wrestle with, it's that, and we haven't come to it yet.
Right. Nonetheless, there is much more of a consensus now among both citizens and historians about the reasons for the war and what happened to it than there would have been in 1865.
No question.
There's this famous story. Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier, was asked, was the French Revolution a success? And he said, well, it's too early to tell. Take a long view. You may not have as a historian the truth right away, but you have to take a long view in an area like history. And one of the things I say is that every generation has to rewrite history because you can't ignore what it is that's happening in our own time. So if you're writing the history of the Roman Empire today, it's going to be different than if you wrote it 100 years ago, because America is in many ways the Roman Empire, and you can't ignore that. That doesn't mean your history is less valid. It means understanding history is different from understanding science, because if we repeated what Galileo did from the Tower of Pisa today, we get exactly the same results. The observer doesn't matter in the way that it does in history.
We're talking with Howard Gardner. His latest book is Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues of the 21st Century. Of course, he brought us multiple intelligences and much more in his work. Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We'll be back in 1 minute. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Howard Gardner is with us once again. It's been a few years. His latest book is Truth, Beauty, and Goodness Reframed, Educating for the Virtues in the 21st Century. There's some complexities here that you raise that I really want to kind of wrestle with here a bit. And one of the things is, a subtext throughout the book is the whole question of modernity, the postmodern era, and the state of the modern digital age, which kind of reframing the arguments from your last book in some ways, the disciplined mind. So, I mean, and you really see the role of this digital media in defining truth, beauty, and goodness as having a pivotal role for the future. And
absolutely,
in some ways optimistic when you look at this younger generation.
Yeah, I guess if I put it in scholarly terms, I'm looking at truth, beauty, and goodness in terms of a philosophical critique on the one hand, and in terms of technological revolutions on the other. And the philosophical critique is variously called postmodernism or relativism. But they boil down to how can you be so damn sure about what it is that you're saying? that's an important question to ask. As I said in my earlier writing, I picked examples where it would have been relatively uncontroversial to talk about what's true, beautiful, and good. But a lot of examples aren't non-controversial. And I think a person who wants to continue using those words, he's got some chits that he's got to redeem. So part of my book is putting forth my definitions of truth, beauty, and goodness. The digital revolution, I am becoming more and more convinced, is as fundamental in our world as the invention of writing was a few thousand years ago and the invention of printing was several hundred years ago. Now, what's interesting about both of those things, it really took centuries to see the implications of writing. I mean, Plato was very worried about it, but he certainly didn't figure out exactly what was going on. And the implications of printing. I mean, it took Marshall McLuhan to really lay out, how the world changed because of printing, though obviously other people thought about it as well. We're in a very funny position now because the digital media are very new. They're at the most 50 years old, and yet because we're much more reflective and we have a lot more chattering classes now, there isn't a day that comes out where somebody writes about why they think the world is different because of chat rooms and because of multi-user games and because of various kinds of search engines and so on. And then events happen like a political candidate says something, or WikiLeaks emerges and suddenly you have somebody's entire email corpus. And so the sequelae of the digital media are much, much more salient now than they would have been in printing, because, it took hundreds of years for books to become really common.
Right.
Whereas now, everybody who has a telephone that's smart is in the digital world. And one of the things I write about a lot in the book is that we all grew up in small neighborhoods, and then as we got older, in developed countries, we could have contact with people who were further away. We could go on airplanes and so on. But now, if you're 6 years old and you can get on the internet, you have contact with everybody else in the world who could get into the internet, and this is a time in life when you can't possibly know what it means to participate in a community like that. And so every day we're reminded about how revolutionary these new media are, and yet I'm not alone in saying that everywhere schools are really preparing people for the 19th and 20th century, even in the systems which are most seen to be advanced, Finland, Singapore, a few other places. Still, there's been very little effort to think about, well, in an age where so many arguments are relativistic, do we just embrace relativism and say, well, you know, what's true for the bongo is fine, and what's true for us is fine? And similarly, I sometimes joke there are two kinds of people, who use Wikipedia and liars. When we know that, you know, 95% of people go first to Wikipedia and probably 90% of students don't go any further, how can we not deal with what has truth value and what doesn't on Wikipedia? And if I can just tell a tiny anecdote [S2] Sure. [S1] On myself, for 3.5 years, I looked at the entry about myself in Wikipedia, [S2] Mm-hmm. [S1] And it was essentially fabricated. Almost all the things in it were not true. And I was just really curious about whether they would ever be corrected.
Uh-huh.
And finally, and I'll confess it on the air, with some help from some friends, we corrected it, and there was some given take back and forth. And now it's very short, but at least last time I looked, it was quite accurate. But, I think Wikipedia is an incredible creation. I take my hat off to Jimmy Wales, who's navigated it. But, you know, the notion that you can look at your entry for 3.5 years and see it as nonsense, that's something people have to know. And, you know, Wikipedia, and I write about this in the book, is actually not about truth value. It's about quoting sources. They want you to quote sources for something. But how do we know whether those sources are reliable? That's a really big question.
That's interesting. You know, as you were saying there was a study that was done, an archive I read in CNET News, again on the web, that Wikipedia, in this new study, they allege is as accurate as a Britannica.
Yeah, no, this is a study that was done in Science about
right.
5 years ago,
right.
And I think it's worth paying attention to and knowing that. Nonetheless, I will say that if you ask me about any serious subject, whether I would rather go to what one or two experts had to say or go to Wikipedia, I would definitely go to one or two experts. I might check to see what Wikipedia says, and if it
right.
says something widely different, I would look at the reference for it. But Wikipedia is kind of I'm going to call it the common denominator. I won't call it the lowest common denominator. But if somebody spent his or her life studying Kant or Jane Austen or quantum mechanics, they're going to be able to explain it in a way that I have more trust in than something where, you know, a high school student can change it the next day. And indeed, you know, there are good studies now of looking at which sorts of things Wikipedia is good at and which sorts of things it's not good at. I mean, evaluating George W. Bush's presidency, you shouldn't go to Wikipedia. But if you're trying to understand some new technology or some new game, and the only people who would contribute are people who know something about it because it's too arcane otherwise, then I'd probably go there rather than wait for the Britannica or whatever its equivalent is, you know, the Oxford Handbook of blah, 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 to come out.
So,
and that's part of being a good consumer. And when I said learning about methods, the more people know about how Wikipedia works or how the Britannica works or how a textbook works or how, you know, let's say David McCulloch works when he does a history and how that's different from a professor at Yale, those are really important things to know, and we can know it, and I think that's where the focus needs to be more and more in school. The other day, a student came up to me, a college student, mm-hmm. and he said kind of a little bit defiantly, he said, Dr. Gardner, I don't know why we should go to school at all, and he took out his handheld. He said, when the answers to all the questions are in here. And I was pretty quick on my feet. I said, yes, young man. Answered all the questions except the important ones. And the important one here is, how the hell did you establish that? What evidence did you use? What would convince you that you're wrong? And if you can't answer those questions, then I'm not terribly interested. Just like in the question in the area of beauty, if you say, I really value this, I'll say, why? In comparison to what? Why is this better than A, B, and C? You don't have to be able to put it in words, but, you know, if it's a piece of music, play it for me. Say what the difference is between this interpretation or that interpretation. And in the area of goodness, if somebody says, well, I knew what to do, it was clear to do this, I'd say, well, did you consider other alternatives? Did you talk to other people? Did you get the argument against abortion? Did you get the argument against stem cell research? Did you get the argument against climate change? So I think in that particular area, it's quite frivolous. I don't think there are strong arguments against the reality of climate change, and I don't think there are very strong arguments about what's causing it. It's basically human, but it's still useful to know that Freeman Dyson, who's a quite established scientist, is skeptical about global warming, so I'd read what he had to say, because he's not a fool.
When you talk about goodness, I think in some ways what you write about here is the three, truth, beauty, and goodness. That goodness may be the toughest to deal with. I mean, it's because, as you said earlier, I mean, that in terms of evolutionary process, goodness was one thing in a tribal setting, in a neighborhood morality that you have, evolving in small groups, growing to this complexity we live in now, and defining that in terms of what is acceptable as good behavior, given the media, and whether I was thinking about the complexity of that with truth, because you have the interesting little piece in there about a journalist who spoke with one of Bush's people, and he said, you don't understand the truth. You can't even get to that. You can't get to it because this is an empire. You don't understand how it really works. Only to say that
we invent the truth.
We invented truth. So, but with goodness, it's even more difficult to kind of universalize that and put your hands around it.
Well, Mark, this is what sounds a bit portentous. This is what I'm devoting my life to. For the last 15 years, I've been trying to understand what good work and good citizenship is. And I think I've made some progress, and some of it's in the book. And we also have a couple of websites, goodworkproject.org and goodworktoolkit.org. But here's the conclusion I've come to. Most people whom I know and most people listening to this program basically are people who believe in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment ideas of progress, rationality, liberty. You know, the ideas of the 18th century. We have to realize that those ideas, however wonderful they may be, were created by a half a dozen French and English Christians or deists living 200 years ago. And in no way can they be expected to speak for all of humanity and for all different civilizations. So I call, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to do so, but I think I have a way of thinking about it, for a new enlightenment. And a new enlightenment has to be based on values which emerge not just from Western Christianity or Judaic Christian or what's sometimes called Abrahamic religions, but also on the most powerful ideas coming out of Confucianism, coming out of Islam, coming out of other established civilized tradition, and those much smaller societies which have figured out sustainability. I mean, were referring earlier to American Indian indigenous tribes. They understand certain things about survival and about maintaining the commons and so on, which we've lost sight of in our much more market economy kind of thing. And the real subject for this century is to forge together an enlightenment which is truly transcendent, which is truly global. And I think the stakes are very high. I don't care what religion you have. I don't care what rituals you have, as long as they're not harming anybody else. But we can't have a set of ethics for law or for journalism which stops at one border and then just becomes entirely different at another border. It won't work. That's the wonderful lesson of the Arab Spring. You can't stop at the border and say, this isn't true here, but it's true on the other side of the border.
Right.
And so this calls for a different kind of commons where whatever area you're dealing with, the different cultures have to put forth the best examples, the best arguments, the best demonstrations of how they do things and why. And let me make this more concrete. I'm a bit of a wanderer. I go through the world trying to find positive examples. A lot of my work, as you may know, is about human beings whom I admire, like Gandhi and people of our own era like Yo-Yo Ma or Bill Drayton or Nelson Mandela. But I also look at societies in which we can learn things. And I'm going to mention three quite disparate ones. One is Scandinavia, and particularly Denmark and Sweden, which I know pretty well, and the kind of social contract they have developed, which is not at all against markets. It's not at all against creativity or individual achievement, but has a much broader helpful sense than in an Anglo-American context. That's one. The second one is a small community, a small city in Italy called Reggio Emilia, which I often quip is really part of Scandinavia, but it's not. It's in northern Italy, and they have the best schools in the world for young people. And people say, well, what happens to the kids after they get older? The answer they give you in Reggio is, look at our community. And the community isn't perfect, but it's a learning community. They really try in this city of 150,000 when things aren't right to get it right. And the third thing, which will surprise everybody, would even surprise me a couple years ago, is looking at Singapore. There's a lot of things that are wrong with Singapore, but there's some things that work really well there. And there are all sorts of moral and ethical things which don't come up there. And I think it's important to understand how a certain kind of responsibility for your work and for your citizenship has been developed in Singapore, even though, as I say, there are a lot of things about the society which I don't admire. And it's also a learning society. 50 years ago, they were drowning babies because they couldn't afford them. Now it's one of the most enterprising places in the world. They're building up their science and their art. And they recently had an election where the dominant party, which is used to winning everything, didn't.
Right, right.
And it's a wake-up call, and they're saying, not let's kill the opposition, but what can we learn from it? And so one of the worst things about America is the notion of American exceptionalism, and that is the notion that we can't learn from other places. Maybe that has a certain truth in 1776 and maybe even in 1820, but it's utter nonsense now. We need to learn from Finland, from Denmark, from Scandinavia, from Reggio Emilia, from Singapore, from China, and all sorts of other places, because in many ways they figured out things better than we have. That's a shocking thought, Mark, is that we may be exceptional now in the extent to which we screw things up. And indeed, most of the wounds in America are self-inflicted, whether they're economic wounds like the meltdowns of 2001 and 2008, neither of which was necessary, neither of which happened in Singapore or Australia or Germany or Canada. And we need to ask, why didn't they happen there? And three wars. We could argue about each one of them, but we don't have to be in any of them. And why, when our own country is falling apart, are we involved in three wars using trillions of dollars? These are self-inflicted wounds. And the arrogance of thinking that only we know how to be, and that we can't learn from other places, whether it's what Rumsfeld called old Europe, or what they call the tigers of the of South Asia, Southeast Asia, is absolute rubbish, to use a mild word.
We can only use mild words in public radio. But if what you're saying, I mean, what I thought of immediately when we're wrestling with this question of truth, beauty, and goodness I was thinking again about Susskind's thing with the interaction with Bush's advisor and what you just said about what America is doing in the world, and in the context of all that. And where does your optimism come from in where you think the future is for a wrestling with these three major pieces of human existence?
Well, people who just heard my last tirade would realize that in many ways I'm quite a pessimist. But even though we might say congenitally or through my family I'm a pessimist, I believe one has to live as an optimist. And I certainly wouldn't be studying good work and good citizenship unless I felt there was hope for that. Otherwise, I would just, tend my own garden like Candide and let the world go to hell in a handbasket. So I look for examples of human beings. You have Slobodan Milosevic, but you also have Nelson Mandela.
Right.
And those are two people. One of them understood people and manipulated them. The other understood people and brought them close together. The movie Invictus is a wonderful capturing of what it is that Mandela was able to do. And similarly, I was listening today to NPR program about how people in Italy don't pay their taxes, and so neither do their immigrants. But in Reggio Emilia, people do pay their taxes because they take a pride in their city, and they know that the schools won't survive unless they're willing to pay taxes. So I look for those positive examples of communities, of organizations, of individuals, and I say, if we screwed it up, we can unscrew it up. But the reason for this book, rather than for my earlier book, is we can't write things, R-I-G-H-T, unless we pay more attention to the reasons why people are dubious about there being a universal good. And then I say, well, look at science, look at health, look at air traffic control. Nobody would tolerate air traffic control with a different rule in every country. I mean, all the autocrats from Saudi Arabia go to the Rayo Clinic when they're sick because they want to have real medicine and real health, not some kind of folk medicine. So if we can do it in science, health, air traffic control, I think we can do it in journalism and in scholarly disciplines and in architecture and engineering and so on. We don't have to do it in the arts. That's open for anybody can cherish anything that they want, but we have to do it in the area of goodness. And, you know, since the Second World War, we do have the United Nations. We have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We have international courts. They don't always work, but these would have been inconceivable even 100 years ago. And so there are steps in the right direction. Half the countries in the world are probably not democracies, but they all call themselves democracies.
Right.
A third of the countries in the world probably still do slavery. But boy, nobody brags about it, whereas, you know, in the South, in the 1850s, it was considered to be the best way of life, and it was really best for the black people to be slaves because they weren't able to be free people. And, you know, we have a president now who's black. That's an enormous difference. So, yeah, I think that there's hope, and I think that the digital media can be mobilized. But like every other technology, I always say with a pencil, you can poke somebody's eye out or you can write beautiful sonnets. And it's no different with the digital media. You can use it to build up a protest against an autocrat, or you can use it to organize a riot to lynch somebody. Those are equally likely.
And again, it can go either way in the existence we live in. But you also believe a part of this has to do with this interaction that has to happen and must happen between generations, between young and old.
Yeah, and that's one of the other, I think, hopeful things, which I didn't realize until I began writing the book, is, you know, they're kind of two stereotypes. The old-fashioned stereotype is the old people know everything, the young people know nothing. And, you know, one of the things about America is we broke away from that perspective. In many ways, it was quite valuable. The other one is the old people are completely useless. We have to depend on the young for everything, and America has, I think, probably gone further in that direction than anything else. What I argue in the book is trying to use technology to tackle the big problems of the world, including the ones I write about, is something where young and old have to work together, because the digital immigrants are never going to be as skilled as the digital natives in navigating the various digital tools and indeed in creating new ones. Those are all being created by young people. But as even Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates would admit, you know, they did a lot of things pretty stupidly in the beginning, and paying attention to people who are not necessarily older, but let's say wiser, and learning from their experience, whether it's an experience in the area of ethics, morality, or professionalism, is very, very important. And I think we need to cherish those people, not because they're old, because they're wise. And, you know, there are some old people who are unwise. There are a few young people who are very wise. But by and large, having experience and learning from it is what wisdom is. And anybody who thinks all the answers are going to come from the handheld, like our little friend who said we don't need education anymore, are just fooling themselves.
But we, as people who are older, get as much from the young as they do from us, but in
absolutely
a different sense.
And, you know, one of the reasons that I stay teaching and one of the reasons I research the digital world is because I love being with people who are less than half my age but can teach me all sorts of things I'd never know before, and that includes my kids and my grandchild. And so, yes, I guess what you're helping me to say, Mark, is this is one of the eras in human history where the balance between old and young can be very, very meritorious.
And we
should take absolutely all the advantage we can, because those periods don't happen all the time.
They do not, and we're in one of those. And I think the other positive thing you talk about towards the end of the book is that this convergence of postmodernism and the digital media may actually, in your mind, and your analysis, looking at it, create the second age of enlightenment.
If we understand what they mean, how they can be used positively, how the more negative aspects can be muted, and we have some kind of goals to shoot for. And the goals are obviously a world which doesn't blow itself up. That's why Gandhi and the people who we influenced, like Martin Luther King and Mandela, and the people in Egypt in Tahrir Square, and the people in China, Tiananmen Square, those people are so important, and the organizations and the institutions which go across borders, whether it's Oxfam or Doctors Without Borders or the kinds of social entrepreneur organizations that Ashoka and other organizations like that foster, if we really pay very great attention to how they work, how they make use of the digital media, and how they learn from their mistakes, how they are learning communities and learning organizations, not in terms of cliche, but learning in terms of how to be better, how to do better work, how to be better citizens, then I think there's reason to be optimistic. One point which I think is worth mentioning mm-hmm. was from my own mentor, John Gardner. He was not a relative of mine, but a very wise man in exactly the way that I've talked about. He said in America, and this was 10 years ago, there's never been so many young people doing so many good things. And yet he said, alas, they are essentially unconnected to the political process. And that means these young people, and there are children, or they may be young people listening to this show now, doing things that are helping hundreds or even thousands of people. But legislation is being passed or not passed, which involves hundreds of thousands or millions of people. And so I think one of the challenges, particularly in the United States, is to somehow forge that social entrepreneurship and that effort to be helpful, to be empathic, to use the common word now, with our political system is a huge challenge. I don't particularly approve everything that's going on in England today. Nonetheless, because they have a parliamentary system and they have elected certain leaders, at least when they want to implement those things and see what works and what doesn't work, they have a chance to do so. When they try to promote something that's too radical, as with the National Health Service, there's a correction process. We are now paralyzed as a political system. And hitting the other guy and keeping him or her from doing anything has become the name of the game. And that's why even someone like me can look at Singapore and say, there is something for having a consensus among people who are pretty wise and know which way to push the society. And unless we can decripple our political system and make it more effective for the 21st century, we are going to be the rubbish pile of history. And alas, while other empires went down without bringing the rest of the world down, I fear that won't be the case with the United States. So the stakes are very, very high.
And I think your friend John, your mentor John Gardner was correct. And Howard Gardner, Truth, Beauty, Goodness, Reframe, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the opportunity very, very much.
Thank you.